Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will it be the Tigers or the Rangers facing the Brewers or the Cardinals in the World Series? Ahead on Only a Game, the latest MLB action. Also, why Motor City football fans are suddenly interested in the Lions not living in the Detroit Zoo. And an NBA guard discovers there are no padlocks on the doors of the halls of academia. Also coming up, a guitar-wielding former NFL lineman lets us in on a secret.
I always loved music and arts. You know, I shouldn't say this in an interview, but I loved it more than sports. Throughout doing football, music was really something that played in my life therapeutically and artistically.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Brewers starting pitcher Zach Greinke didn't strike anybody out last night, which meant he had to depend on his fielders. Big mistake. The Brewers committed four errors, and the Cardinals beat them 7-1 to take a 3-2 lead in the National League Championship Series. The two teams play again tomorrow in Milwaukee. Here to update us on the end of the long march to the World Series is ESPN's Tim Kirkchian. He's on the line from St. Louis. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. St. Louis is now one game away from the World Series. A certain expert said something like the Cardinals don't have what it takes to advance much further. Wasn't that long ago?
Yeah, I think that was me, Bill. Thanks for bringing that up.
At least I didn't play the tape.
Yeah, I think the Phillies are at home saying, how can we not be in the league championship series? How can we not be going to the World Series? But at the same time, they were beaten fair and square by the Cardinals. And I must say, Bill, this has been an imperfect league championship series in a lot of ways. It has been fascinating to watch. And I must say, there is something special going on with the Cardinals, whether it's their ability to dodge trouble as they did all year, and when they did get in trouble and lost these horrible games, they did always find a way to bounce back. So they are a resilient group, and they have a manager that just keeps them playing hard, and they're a very interesting team to watch, even though they're not really perfect every time out.
There have been four Major League Baseball wild cards that have gone on to win the World Series: the 97 Marlins, 2002 Angels, 2003 Marlins, and, of course, the 04 Red Sox. But did any of those teams clinch the wild card on the last day of the regular season as the Cardinals did this year?
Well, actually, they didn't. And this is what being a wild card team sometimes can mean, is you barely get into the playoffs. You have been playing playoff games for over a month just to get in, and sometimes that momentum actually works in your favor. Now, I think most teams would rather win the division, coast in, set up their pitching, and go from there. That's not the way the Cardinals did it, but again, the Cardinals didn't do anything in an easy fashion this year. But I think the degree of difficulty of the season has prepared these guys for the difficulties of the postseason. And again, there's something special going on with the Cardinals, especially when they play in St. Louis. I've never seen so much red in my entire life.
In the American League Championship Series, the Texas Rangers are up 3-2 over Detroit. What are the chances the Rangers make it back to the World Series 2 years in a row?
Bill, I think they are. They have a devastating offensive team. Keep in mind, they made it to the World Series last year with a good offensive team. And since then, they've added Adrian Beltre to play third and Mike Napoli behind the plate. And both of those guys have had very good offensive seasons. So now they don't have an out 1-9 in their order. Also, if you remember this time last year, they had a subpar bullpen after their closer. Well, they added three bullpen pieces to their team down the stretch. And they took Alexi Ogando, who's a starting pitcher who throws 100 miles an hour, and now they use him in the seventh or the eighth inning occasionally, and that's another weapon. So they are a better team than the team that went to the World Series last year, and I think they're going back this year.
Tim, Red Sox general manager Theo Epstein will apparently be going to the Cubs, although that hasn't been made official yet. What's holding up the deal? Minor leaguers, money, or what brand of goat will be heading to Boston?
It's the compensation is what I'm told, and it's a very complicated situation because the Cubs, I'm told, only want to give up money, and naturally the Red Sox say, we've got enough of that. What we don't have enough of is prospects, so they want players in return, and it's getting very cumbersome. And it's not just the two general managers trying to work this out because, of course, the Cubs really don't have a general manager yet, and neither do the Red Sox because theirs is losing, so now it's going between the owners and all these other people, and they're having a difficult time deciding how much it's worth to bring Theo Epstein over. Eventually, I think this is going to happen, but it's a complicated situation.
The Red Sox, until recently, had been perceived as one of the more well-run teams in baseball, but given all that's gone on in the last couple of weeks, not to mention their stunning collapse throughout September, was that perception just wrong?
Well, it certainly is now, because it was a very well-run organization, and it has done some tremendous things for baseball, certainly for Boston, and everything for the Red Sox to make that club relevant again every single year, rebuild that brand. But now everything is crumbling down under the weight of the firing of Terry Francona, or resignation, whatever you call it. And then he was not treated very well as he went out the door, which seems to be a Boston Red Sox tradition for some reason. And now they're going to lose their general manager, and people are up in arms in Boston in every way. And when we have Boston columnists comparing this to the worst times in Red Sox history, when they went years and years without winning, that's a really bad sign. And this fall, just look at this team at the end of August, beginning of September, where they were and how well things were going, and just look at it 6 weeks later. It's an amazing fall by a big-time baseball team.
Tim Kirkchin covers Major League Baseball for ESPN. Tim, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
NBA owners and locked-out players will meet on Tuesday with a federal mediator in an attempt to save the 2011-2012 season. Earlier this week, the NBA announced the cancellation of the first 2 weeks of same. For some players, the work stoppage has been a chance to travel, rest, or nurse nagging injuries. For one young player, it's meant a return to the college life. From WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Graff reports.
Stephen Curry learned a long time ago about the importance of education. It was his seventh grade year. That fall, he brought home a 2.8 GPA. And his mom, who also happens to be the headmaster at a nearby Montessori school, didn't like it.
I missed 3 days of practice the week before our season was to start, going to a tutor and working on getting my grades up above the level where she thought they were supposed to be.
His mom had benched him. The missed practice time led coaches to sit Curry for what was supposed to be his first ever middle school game. 6 years later, Curry landed at Davidson College in North Carolina. The tiny liberal arts school is better known for its rigorous academics than for its basketball. But as a sophomore, Curry led his team on an improbable run to the NCAA's Elite Eight. A year later, Curry did something else unusual for a Davidson student. He left college without a degree.
With the seventh pick in the 2009 NBA draft, the Golden State Warriors select Stephen Curry from Davidson College.
Stephen would follow in his father's footsteps. His dad, Dell, spent 16 years in the NBA. His mom, Sonia, though, was not thrilled.
For him to be just one season away or 1 year away from completing his college experience, finish what you start, son. Because, again, you just don't know what's in the future.
But before he left Davidson, Curry did promise he would spend summers finishing his degree. And with the lockout looming this year, Curry decided he'd take classes this fall on campus.
You doing all right?
Yeah, how are you?
Fall break. You're horrible.
I know. I'm just joking. Good to see you guys.
See you too, sir.
In between classes, Curry takes a moment to say hi to some friends in the student union. He's on campus Tuesdays and Thursdays, driving an hour from the home he shares with his new wife. Curry also signs autographs, about 50 so far, he guesses, including one for a fellow student's little brother the first week of school. The person making the request, the boy's mom.
She actually ripped one of the flyers off the bulletin board and folded it in half on the backside and asked me to autograph it for her son so she could take it home. Because he warned her that he saw that I was back on campus, and that if his mom saw me, that she was required to get the, at least ask for an autograph.
Davidson senior Jessica Hartley says it's fun having Curry back on campus. The two were friends before Stephen left for the NBA, and she still sees him as a peer. But some others don't.
Because I've definitely been eating with him and had someone, one of the staff members, come up and get an autograph for their, like, nephew, and another person, like, on a tour group come over and get a picture with him. And it's just, like, really awkward because it kind of throws you out of the element, like, having a conversation about normal things, and someone comes over and is like, oh, can I get your autograph? And you're like, wait a second, he's famous, I forgot.
Curry's return may be a big deal to some, but Professor Rick Gay, who has Curry in his History of Education class, says outside of some hubbub the first day or two, everything has been pretty normal. In fact, going into the new year, no one even told Gay that Curry would be in one of his classes.
There's nothing special about his being in the class at all. He's acts like a regular student. He shows up, does his work, participates in class discussion, and so he's just one of the students in the class.
That doesn't mean that Gay and other professors at Davidson aren't impressed by what Curry is doing.
I try to put myself in his situation, and I'm wondering if I had those available resources and the time off, whether I wouldn't be hanging out in South Beach for a few months instead of going back to college.
He doesn't have South Beach flair, but there are some things about Curry that are more NBA than college kid. His car? It's a Mercedes SUV. And sometimes Curry reads textbooks and writes his papers on airplanes. Why? Because he often flies on weekends to other cities so he can work out with fellow NBA players. Curry admits he'd rather be playing basketball than learning how to research his senior thesis. We talked with him on what was supposed to be the opening day of training camp.
We're in the morning, so I'd be waking up getting ready to go to practice for the first day, and knowing that this is when that's supposed to happen and the work that you put in through the summer to get your body ready for this time of the year, and you're not playing because of a labor dispute, it's kind of frustrating.
But he says he's just making the best of a bad situation. And in the process, he's also making people like his former Davidson coach, Bob McKillop, very proud.
Every player that I have coached here has graduated with the exception of Stephen. And I tell him that all the time. Not that he needs any humbling, but he's making very certain that that record remains intact.
Curry says he thinks the lockout will need to last until November for him to get far enough along in his courses that his professors would allow him to finish remotely. If the lockout ends before that, Curry may not get any credit for the work he's done this semester. But he says that was a risk he understood going in. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On November 5th, Alabama will play LSU, and football may not be the tastiest attraction. Oh, sure, both teams are highly regarded. Each comes carrying a substantial football tradition. But can the game match for drama and spice the day-long celebration of Gumbo, which promoters have dubbed the Louisiana Gumbo Bowl? The highlight of the day might be a touchdown pass or a last-minute field goal, but how can that compete with the creation of a record-breaking gumbo consisting of 705 pounds of shrimp, 100 pounds of claw crab meat, 200 pounds of sliced onions, and 200 pounds of alligator meat? It's all for charity, so laissez-les bons gumbo rouler.
I will play for gumbo. Oh, yeah, I will play for gumbo. The French bread with which I wipe my mold. Good for the body, good for the soul. It's a little like religion.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a towering former NFL lineman pours out his heart via song. But first, the Detroit Lions defeated the Chicago Bears 24-13 on Monday night. The Lions are 5-0, and with apologies to Percy Bysshe Shelley, they've arisen after slumber and shaken their chains to earth like dew. But will they stay awake long enough to claw their way into the team's first Super Bowl? Here to answer that question is Dave Burkett, who covers the team for the Detroit Free Press. Dave, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The Lions' last NFL title came in 1957. They've been pretty awful for decades, and the 2008 team was the first and so far only NFL squad to go 0-16 since the NFL went to a 16-game regular season format. Have Detroit fans been able to forget that wretched history and get solidly behind the current team?
Well, I don't know if you ever totally forget it. I mean, even during their 5-0 start so far, I've gotten a bunch of emails from people wondering whether they should completely buy in, and I tell them the same thing that I'll tell you. I think this is a totally different team, from the players in the locker room to the management upstairs to the coaching staff. And I think it all starts with some of that talent. I mean, guys like Calvin Johnson and Ndamukong Suh, even Matthew Stafford, are some of the best players in the NFL right now.
So these guys are not sort of thinking, we're going to fall back to earth at some time and be the Lions again. This is a whole new attitude.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I've talked about that with a couple guys in the locker room this week. And basically, since the NFL expanded its playoff format in 1990, 32 of the 36 teams that have started 5-0 have made the playoffs. So I think they're well aware of just how fragile things can be in the NFL, and they're pretty determined to make sure that they see this through all the way.
The only other undefeated NFL team is Green Bay, defending champions, of course. Kind of a shame the Lions and Packers are in the same division, isn't it?
Could make for some pretty exciting football. I mean, the Lions and Packers play on Thanksgiving, and, you know, you mentioned some of the history with the Lions. You know, for years that's been kind of a dreary game that a lot of people have tuned out on Thanksgiving, and that should be a thriller this year. And then they meet again in Week 17 in a game that could be for maybe the NFC North, maybe a playoff berth is on the line. I think there's a lot of excitement for what both those games could mean this year.
If that Thanksgiving Day game is good, and if the Lions prevail, I can imagine a national clamor of people saying, hey, let the Lions play on every holiday.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, the Monday night game that they had this past week against Chicago, it was electric, Bill. It was the best atmosphere I've ever seen, the loudest I've ever heard that stadium. And if the Lions keep winning, I think the sense is that they will get invited back to primetime again this year, you know, have a couple of their games flexed into the Sunday night spot. And a game like Green Bay on Thanksgiving would only, you know, further that. The NFL knows what sells. You know, they know how to make money, and networks are clamoring for the Lions right now because of the story and because of the players that they have, and I think wins will only continue that.
Has anybody around the team in Detroit been saying, well, yeah, but, you know, the five teams the Lions have beaten are in no way the cream of the crop of the NFL?
I think some of that started to dissipate a little bit. I mean, I think early on, you know, they said, your first three wins are against some teams that haven't looked particularly good, and you had to come back, you know, from 20-point deficits in two of your wins. But maybe they're not the best team in the NFL. You know, the Packers, the Ravens, you know, the Patriots, the Saints, those are some pretty good teams. But, you know, maybe after those four, they are as good as anybody in the NFL. And who knows, maybe they are as good as any of those guys, because they're going to play the Saints and the Packers later this year and find out.
The Lions will face 4-1 San Francisco tomorrow. How do you expect the Lions to do against the 49ers?
Well, it should be a good game. I mean, I think I'm a little bit worried about sort of a letdown effect coming off that Monday night game. But at home, with Calvin Johnson on your team, the way the Lions are playing defensively as a whole, I think the Lions have a little bit more firepower. I think they'll pull it out.
I'm told that anybody who bet that the Lions would go 0-16 a few years ago really cleaned up. I wonder if you've turned up anybody around Detroit who's bet before this season started that they'd go 16-0.
You know, I threw it out on Twitter one day. Actually, I said, did anybody, after the Bills had their hot start too, I said, did anybody have the Bills and the Lions meet in the Super Bowl? I wonder what those odds were. And somebody tweeted me back and said, you know, they didn't have that, but they had the Lions and the Patriots, and they got 50-1 odds on that. So I know the Lions are more favored to go to the Super Bowl now. I think it's, you know, under 10-1. They're on a pretty remarkable streak here, and I think it's right to buy in, because these guys, they do have some pretty good players now.
Dave Burkett covers the Lions for the Detroit Free Press. Dave, thanks very much for speaking with me.
No problem. We'll do it again.
Blue bruised knuckles and a broken back.
physically speaking, that's all that's left of that. Red, white, and blue, silver, warm. I left that part of my life for something more.
That's Brian Barthelmess singing with his band, which is called Tallahassee. The song is called Mount Moriah, and it's on a CD titled Jealous Hands. Brian Barthelmess, who has previously been employed by the New England Patriots as an offensive lineman, joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure being here.
Brian, when you left that CD off for me, you included a note about Mount Moriah, which you said is, quote, about me leaving football, hence the lines, bruised knuckles and a broken back. Physically speaking, that's all that's left of that. I'm hoping that the lyric, at least the part about the broken back, isn't literal.
A tad bit. It's not broken, but there's quite a bit of herniated discs and good wear down the lower back.
You played on the Patriots practice squad for a year, from May 2006 to August 07. You also spent one season in NFL Europe. Were you surprised that you didn't get beyond that point as a pro?
Not necessarily. To be fully candid, one of the reasons I went in the NFL was kind of a lack of knowing what to do next after college. A lot of guys have big dreams of football. That was not necessarily ever one of mine. You know, I spent a little time bouncing around, and the industry of football wasn't necessarily something I loved, but not a surprise, but a really good experience.
Plus, it must have been obvious when you got to camp you didn't really have the size for the pros. What are you, only about 6'6", 280 pounds, something like that?
Well, I'm 280 now. I was about 315 at the time.
315.
Yeah, so I like to claim, I don't know if it's the truth, but tallest center in the league for at least one season.
Did you make a transition from football player to musician, or have you been a musician all along?
I always loved music and arts. You know, I shouldn't say this in an interview, but I loved it more than sports. And so I guess when I was probably 20 or 21, I got really interested in songwriting. And so I hadn't really played much music before that, and I got a guitar and a banjo. In college, I was having a lot of mental health issues. Suffering from depression, a lot of things. At the same time, trying to play football, trying to find motivation to keep doing that. I couldn't afford school or be in school if it wasn't for football. And so I was using that as a creative outlet, and I'm a very creative person. So yeah, throughout doing football, music was really something that played in my life therapeutically and artistically.
You've brought your guitar, albeit not the rest of the members of Tallahassee today. So would you play the CD's title song, Jealous Hands?
Yeah, sure.
Take what you want, love, from my jealous hands, and go where you want, darling. I won't be waiting there, where the houses are all crooked, bow-legged and broke. The ground we once waltzed on smells of cinders and smoke. Whiskers are overgrown. I hear the labors of the brakeman on his last route home. The black bear's gone hungry on his diet of oats. Some things I don't remember, some I choose not to know.
black moon sky, stumbling home, broken back door, how'd I get here alone? It says that Ellis Island is for immigrants, that's the trophy I wore. Well, I've done my time, yes, I have paid my debts, yes, I have sown the garden.
There's a line in that song, Jealous Hands, that I found especially powerful. Matter of fact, it's my favorite line from the entire CD. The ground we once waltzed on smells of cinders and smoke. That is quite an image.
Thank you very much.
Are you the lyricist as well as the singer?
Yeah, I do a lot of the lion's share of writing. Our other guitar player and songwriter does some as well, but most of that song is all my lyrics.
I'm wondering if the world of football and the world of music ever literally overlap. Say if somebody you once played beside or against walks into a club where Tallahassee is playing and says, hey, I know that guy.
Well, it hasn't happened in that fashion quite yet. I'll tell you one of my favorite stories of music overlapping. So when I was on the practice squad, I had really gotten into playing bluegrass and mandolin and banjo. And this kind of caught on throughout the team. And I had a locker next to Junior Seau at the time. And he asked if I'd give him a guitar lesson. And so it was tough. His hands are huge and knuckles are the size of golf balls. And so we actually got him a 12-string guitar and took off all the octave strings.
Ah.
So I started giving him a lesson. And the next thing I knew, I was teaching Teddy Bruschi how to play the mandolin and Matt Light how to play guitar. And so I think at a certain
point... How did they let you go?
I was employed as a player at the time, not a musical therapist. Mm. So that's where it started. And, a lot of the lyrics in the songs, Jealous Hands is about a lot of stuff I went through in college that dealt with football and some of my mental health issues. And so I think a lot of times people I've played with recognize a lyric out of there and they're like, oh, like that is that instance where this or that happened, or, you know, I recognize this. And so that occurs quite a bit.
Obviously, both pro athletes and musicians are performers. Do you feel there's any other similarity between what you used to do and what you're doing now?
Oh, for sure. It's actually striking how many similarities. The same hard work, focus, all of those things in football that you learn about the repetitive nature of viewing films. Of, you know, when you're a lineman, you learn to take one step at a time, one step, one step. It's a lot of muscle memory. And similarly, in songwriting, there's a lot of the same practice. My band always laughs that I run our practices very much like a football practice schedule. So I actually have a schedule that I write out, and it says, you know, warm-ups, you know, which in football is stretching and then blocking drills. And in rock and roll, it's like jamming out to Leonard Skinner-esque blues. And so, and then I block off, work on songs we know for live, work on new songs. I operate them in the same fashion, as well as on tour, I lead everyone through stretches. So before we record or when we're touring, I always get everyone out, make them do calisthenics. So yeah, surprisingly, there's way too many similarities.
Possibly the healthiest band on tour today.
I'd like to say that, yeah.
One feature of pro sports is that it's not difficult to tell when you've made it. You're either on the team or you got cut. Hmm. I assume that in the music business, it's not that clear cut.
Well, you would be surprised how unclear it is in the NFL as well. A lot of the reasons I ended up leaving, I had actually been cut and picked up probably four times. You know, while I was technically in the NFL, I would be residing in Virginia, doing workouts in Buffalo or in New York. then getting picked back up by the Pats, coming up there for a few weeks. And so there was a lot of ambiguity between what my role was, what I was working towards, where I stood. And so I think in the music industry, it's the same way. And the biggest thing I've learned, which, you know, if I knew this when playing football, it may have ended differently, although my passions lie elsewhere. But it's about being kind of who you are in that moment and really appreciating what you're doing. And so sometimes I try and combat the arduous ambiguity of both of those by just being where I am.
How is Tallahassee doing?
We're doing really well. We are doing some promotion stuff and rising on college radio charts and gaining more and more fans every time we play. So that's going well, but you know, I honestly measure a lot of our success by how we're doing in life emotionally and mentally. And so I think more than ever, we're incredibly close friends and musicians, which nothing beats that feeling, which, you know, athletes and musicians alike can all agree upon.
Well, I have a career move for you.
Okay.
My sources tell me that Hank Williams Jr. is no longer in play for Monday Night Football, and it seems to me Tallahassee would be the natural choice of a band to submit a lead-in song to Monday Night Football. Get busy.
I am going to tell the boys we need to write a lead-in. I think this is a great idea.
Ryan, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure speaking with you and, of course, listening to your music.
Likewise.
As well.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Barthelmess, late of the New England Patriots practice squad, currently sings and plays guitar, banjo, and harmonica for Tallahassee. He also writes their lyrics. Their current CD is Jealous Hands.
Hatchet in my hands and stones under my feet, begging the sweet love for my mind.
To hear more in-studio performances by Brian Barthelmess or learn more about his band, Tallahassee, please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
As I wait for the coming of the storm, you left me with a cross around my neck, a rosary to pray on and a mouthful of regret. Said you'd be returned for the changing of the moon.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
If you hit your golf ball into the lake on the Carbrook Gold Course in Brisbane, Australia, it's gone. No trying to hit it out of the lake, even if the ball is really close to the shore. That's taboo, says golfer Graham Casemore. If you value your limbs, you don't go anywhere near the lake. Since a flood over a decade ago, the lake has been home to numbers of bull sharks. Golfers sometimes see fins breaking the surface, which must be a tad distracting when they're trying to figure out whether to lay up short and then worry about the killer badgers and the electric eel that lives in the hole when they get to the green. Nah, I'm only kidding about the eel. Go to Brisbane, play some golf. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Thanks to the Saints, the truth has football. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
NBA owners and union reps will meet next week with a federal mediator. The league has already canceled the first 2 weeks of the regular season, and now David Stern is expressing doubt that games scheduled for December 25th can be saved if an agreement is not reached by Tuesday. Does Mr. Stern really want to be known as the commissioner who stole Christmas?
No, he's going to blame the players for stealing Christmas from those millions of American youngsters who push aside their new Xboxes and G.I. Joes with the Kung Fu grip just to watch the traditional NBA doubleheader on Christmas Day. What a guy.
The Brewers, Cardinals, Tigers, and Rangers all inched closer to the World Series this week. Which two teams do you think would make for the best, most entertaining series matchup?
The most entertaining series matchup, I would like to see Milwaukee and Detroit just because for the pure Rust Belt charisma of it. If I were King of the Forest, you'd be Milwaukee, Detroit, would have Blatts versus Strohs, and it would be a wonderful time.
The Red Sox did not make the playoffs, but they've certainly been making the tabloids, Charlie. Could chicken, beer, and video games in the clubhouse during games really be responsible for the departures of manager Terry Francona and general manager Theo Epstein?
Well, if you believe the anonymous friends of the Boston Globe, probably two sets of Red Sox ownership talking to each other, it was also because Terry Francona was a wife-dumping drug addict. This has been an incredible mess. This is a cutthroat, nasty organization, and any free agent that signs here should have his head examined. That being said, it's pretty obvious that we have some Red Sox players who are not too enthusiastic about their jobs, and the sooner they get rid of Josh Beckett, the better.
With Epstein as their general manager, will the Cubs suddenly be an attractive bet to win it all sometime in the next couple of years?
Well, I was just in Chicago, and that is a big noise out there. Let me tell you, they are very excited to have Theo Epstein coming in. I think the one thing you can say about Theo Epstein is that he really knows how to hire good young people. His successor in Boston is likely to be Ben Cherington, a very talented baseball guy. So the first thing Theo Epstein will build at the Cubs is a front office, which will be more than capable of rebuilding the franchise.
There were rumblings this week that professional tennis players who've expressed disgruntlement over pay and length of the competitive season were considering unionizing. Good idea?
It's a good idea, but these are the most selfish athletes on the planet. There's no way they're going to get together and have a union.
News this week suggested that perhaps the Big East Conference could soon be renamed the Bigger East. I won't ask you to describe the myriad ramifications, but what does bear explanation perhaps is why a football team in Idaho would be joining the Big East.
Well, let's establish one thing about this great planet of ours, Bill. Everything is east of someplace else.
So technically, and lots of things are big.
And lots of things are big, exactly. Idaho, for example, is big.
It's a big state.
It's not Montana, but it's a big state. So I think that it makes more than enough sense to put the traditional rivals, Rutgers and Boise State, mm-hmm. in the same league together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I, for one, am looking for a resumption of that traditional rival.
The Miami Dolphins, 0-4 this fall, and their attendance has reflected their lack of success, but I understand that they may get a boost at the gate a week from Sunday. Is that right?
This is a very bizarre thing. We've got the trading deadline in the NFL coming up. The Denver Broncos have announced that Tim Tebow will start, but the Denver Broncos have a bye this week. So Tim Tebow is scheduled to start on October 23rd in Miami, which is boosting Miami's ticket sales. It is the modus operandi of every NFL team to play the cards so close to the vest that they're behind the guy playing the cards. So why you would announce that you're making this monumental shift at quarterback a week before you actually have to do it and prior to the trade deadline is a very curious operation. But whatever it is, it's been very helpful to Miami.
You're not suggesting kickbacks to Denver from Miami?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
It's just very, very contrary to the way the average NFL team does business.
I don't know how many NFL fans there are in Great Britain, Charlie, but is it fair to say that they were all celebrating this week?
Yeah, the NFL will be playing in Britain through 2016, much to the consternation of its coaches and players, and much to the happiness of the 38 real NFL fans there are in the United Kingdom.
We're a bit late to the party, but I believe we should offer a tip of the Only a Game cap to the U.S. women's gymnastics team. Would you please do the honors?
Yes, they routed the Russians for the World Championship, despite the fact that Olympic captain Alicia Sakharmon isn't competing anymore. It was a terrific win. They finished 4 points ahead of Russia, which I am told by gymnastics people is a real kicking.
This week, we learned that three former NHL players are suing longtime hockey analyst Don Cherry for some of his remarks. What could he have said to provoke those players to call their attorneys?
Well, Chris Nyland, Jim Thompson, and Stu Grimson made a point that they would like to see fighting taken out of hockey. And Don Cherry, who's been an embarrassment in two countries for 30 years now, called them pukes and hypocrites and turncoats. Don Cherry is a fool and a joke, and people who take him seriously ought to be embarrassed. And the only thing you have to remember about Don Cherry is this. At the biggest moment of his coaching career, he couldn't count to six.
I should probably explain that was when he was coaching the Bruins.
Yes.
They were penalized for having too many men on the ice, and hence a championship in 79 down the tube.
And that's why what I said was very funny.
I was just afraid that not everybody would get it. I imagine that you're celebrating this week, Mr. NASCAR. Not only is the Cup chase about as tight as it can be, but Jimmie Johnson made the cover of Sports Illustrated this week.
That's
although,
not a good...
yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure Jimmie Johnson is celebrating.
Well, I just hope that the curse doesn't extend to motorsports because you can do some real damage to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the top five drivers in the Sprint Cup standings are now separated by a mere 12 points. So this is exactly what NASCAR was aiming for at the time it invented this thing, when a lot of NASCAR purists said it was sort of bowdlerizing the sport.
The British government is making noises about getting involved in the administration of professional soccer in England. Charlie, what stirred up Sports Minister Hugh Robertson and his colleagues?
Well, at least some of it has to do with half of the 20 clubs being owned by people outside the UK, including, I might add, Liverpool, who's owned by the management group who just fired Terry Francona here in Boston.
The very same. On Sunday, as Tiger Woods was trying to play better golf at the Fries.com Open, some guy threw a hot dog at him, and this was mysterious until the guy explained why he'd done it, and then it got more mysterious, right?
Yeah, some guy has been sitting through too many trailers for Michael Bay movies, I'm afraid. Brandon Kelly told the local newspaper that he's a fan of Woods and was watching a movie called Drive, and I'm not exactly sure what this has to do with golf, since the movie's about a guy who's a stunt driver who also moonlights as a getaway driver. But the guy, but Brandon Kelly, inspired by the movie, said, "I have to do something courageous and epic. I have to throw a hot dog on the green in front of Tiger." You want to do something epic? Throw a tiger on the green in front of Tiger. That's courageous and epic. Eat the hot dog and throw the tiger.
And finally, Charlie, it was a weird week for marathoners. On Sunday, Amber Miller had every reason to cut short her run in the Chicago Marathon, but she didn't, and then she gave birth shortly after the race. On the other hand, Rob Sloan, quote, running, end quote, a marathon near Newcastle, England, had no excuse, right?
Yeah, I think Amber Miller should be put immediately on a Virgin Atlantic Airlines flight first class and flown to England, and give Rob Sloan, who took a bus to finish third in the marathon because he got tired, a piece of her mind. And show this prissy Brit how we Yanks and former colonials do it over here.
Charlie Pierce blogs about politics for Esquire magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
According to a survey published last month by USA Football, the youth sports national governing body, Louisiana boasts more NFL players per capita than any other state in the nation. It's unlikely that any of the football players currently playing at Sojourner Truth Academy in New Orleans will ever go pro, but there is an NFL connection there. This fall, thanks to support from the New Orleans Saints and the NFL, the school is fielding a varsity football team for the very first time. The Sojourner Truth Jaguars won't ever be compared to the 1972 Dolphins, last year's Packers, or the 1985 Bears, but the players currently wearing the school's red, white, and black jerseys don't seem to mind. From New Orleans, Keith O'Brien has the story.
Hey, kick off right here. Kick off right here. Let them know. Let them know. Where the his squad at, baby?
There is no marching band here, as usual. No cheerleaders and hardly any fans. At kickoff on this late September night, the Sojourner Truth Jaguars have just one fan in the bleachers, and he sort of has to be here. He's the school superintendent. But in the minutes before kickoff of the Jaguars' fifth game of their inaugural varsity season, coaches deal with a more pressing issue, an issue typical of this inexperienced team. One of the Jaguars' key offensive linemen, Toy Kelly, has brought the wrong helmet to the game.
This is large. What size you wear?
Extra large must be.
The coaches scramble to find a teammate to swap with Toy. They need every player they've got. In a sport where teams routinely dress 70 players or more, Sojourner Truth, this year, has only 23. Barely enough to field a squad.
Let's see if Dante can fit this one. Take it out real quick and see if you can fit this.
Man, what size is that?
That's a large. Think you can do a large?
No.
Sojourner Truth Academy opened in 2008. One of many charter schools to open in this city after Hurricane Katrina. The location was an old Catholic school in uptown New Orleans, and the students who enrolled often came from single-parent homes or neighborhoods plagued by crime.
Violence, gunshots.
Donald Nolan, Sojourner Truth's starting wide receiver, was just a boy, he says, when his older brother was shot and killed outside a nightclub. And today, around his neck, Donald still wears his brother's black rosary as a reminder of the one who is gone.
My brother had it before he died. And you know, it was his good luck charm. So I used this as a good luck charm.
The mission of the school at its founding was simple. Prepare kids like Donald for college and instill the values of the former slave, abolitionist, and activist for whom the school is named. But the student body, which is 97% African American, rarely calls the school by its full name, says Superintendent Reginald Flannery. The kids simply call themselves the Truth.
I wonder sometimes if our students really know that our name is Sojourner Truth, because our nickname across the entire city is Truth. But if you're going to have a nickname, I mean, it's kind of hard to beat that one.
A small gymnasium allowed the Truth to assemble a basketball team from the start, but football was too expensive. Impossible, really. Until the school's co-founder, Shauna Mae Cook, reconnected with an old classmate from Stanford University, Saints defensive back Lee Torrance.
You know, I'd gotten to do some stuff with her in the school before, and she started talking about them wanting to start a football program. And I was like, man, this, you know, we got to make this happen. You know, it's just like, it fits.
Torrance told his teammates about the school, and soon, 10 Saints players had donated $5,000 each, a $50,000 sum that was then matched by the NFL. Saints defensive back Malcolm Jenkins, for one, says he didn't hesitate to give.
Not everybody's, you know, going to get an academic scholarship, but not everybody's big in academics, you know, and a lot of people need other outlets. And, you know, even if it's not something that's going to take them far to the NFL or anything like that, it's just something that they can use to occupy time, to enjoy fellowship with other schoolmates and classmates, and something that just, you know, help them stay active.
Let's go, Day! Day! Day!
But even $100,000 can't buy the Truth a field. The boys practice instead on a small playground, next to a cemetery, amidst rows of shotgun houses. The patch of grass is maybe 40 by 20 yards, not even close to a regulation-size field. It's enough, however, for conditioning drills, which is what the boys need. With just 23 players on the roster, most have to play both offense and defense, rarely resting over the course of a 48-minute game.
I play running back, linebacker, quarterback, punt return, kick return, pretty play, all over the field.
I guess you sort of have to, right?
Yeah, I have to. You have to step up for your team. You got to do what you got to do.
Byron Jarrow is a senior with dreams of playing in college. But like many Jaguars, he is undersized, about 5'8", 160 pounds. And some, like Derek Wilson, are much smaller. Wilson plays outside linebacker, and he's just 4'10", 108 pounds.
Got to get the job done. And you ain't got to be the biggest guy to always do it.
For the most part this fall, though, the biggest guys have been the ones doing all the winning. Sojourner Truth lost 3 of its first 4 games, was shut out twice along the way, and outscored in total 106-24. But going into the 5th game of the season, head coach Perry McCarty isn't too worried about their record. All he wants to see, he says, is that the kids are playing hard.
When they start hanging their heads, like, that's when we have an issue, because I'm not going to hang my head. Like, I'm not going to be embarrassed about them. If they gave 100%, and they gave 100%. And we're going to get better. We're always striving to get better at whatever we're doing. Like I said, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's on the field, or whatever it may be, we're going to get better.
In the minutes before kickoff that night, McCarty doesn't get flustered about the lost helmet. The coaches find one that works for Toy Kelly, and then the Truth prepares to take the field to play Sophie B. Wright, a rival charter school.
We're dominating!
Get up!
We're dominating!
Get up!
We're dominating!
Get up!
Let's go!
Let's
go!
Let's
go!
No!
As usual for the Truth, it doesn't start well. But then the Jaguars score, 6-0. Then they score again, 12-0. Sophie B. Wright answers with a touchdown of its own, but the Truth answers back. At halftime, McCarty's team is up 20-6, the school's biggest lead ever. The school's fans, about 50 strong now, begin to cheer. Sophie B. Wright begins to press, throwing the ball more and more, and then it happens. Little Derek Wilson, all 4'10" of him, leaps into the air, intercepts the ball, and the boys start to celebrate, falling all over themselves on the sideline.
Hey, got the shortest man on the field jumped up there and got that. Hey,
every time
there you go, Derek.
There are still 10 minutes to go in the game, but this one is over. For the second time in their very brief history, the Sojourner Truth boys are winners, and they know exactly what to do. They pose for pictures, find some Gatorade to dump on a coach, and then, for a long time, linger beneath the lights of the field, just like football players. For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien.
Hey, man, I know you can jump that high.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jillian Guybe. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Keith O'Brien's Sojourner Truth photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Brian Barthelmess. I asked him why his band had agreed on the name Tallahassee and not, oh, say, Toad the Wet Sprocket.
That was what we went for first. I mean, you know, that just has a ring to it you can't touch.
Yeah, it's pretty good, but not as good as Olivia Tremor Control or the Vanilla Train Wreck. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.